This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
During the Reformation, people had to choose between the Protestant and Catholic faith, or so the popular narrative goes. But is it really that simple? I'm your host, Kim Koenig, and in this podcast interview, I'm joined by GHIL Deputy Director and Early Modern Historian Michael Scheich. Together, we talk to Matthias Pohlig, Professor of Early Modern European History at the Humboldt-Universität Berlin, about the research behind his GHIL lecture on religious decision-making in the early German Reformation. Welcome, Matthias. Thank you so much for joining us on the GHIL podcast. You gave a lecture a few weeks ago on religious decision-making in the early Reformation, and I wanted to jump right in and ask you if you could give us a bit of a background about your research topic and how you came to research on this particular theme.
The topic of religious decision-making in the early German Reformation, because that's what I'm actually doing research on, this topic was developed in the context of a collaborative research project at the University of Münster in Germany, where we discussed cultures of decision making in a more general context in pre-modern and modern societies. For instance, the question if medieval and early modern societies were more reluctant to give individuals the right to make their own decisions was a question that we discussed very thoroughly. And in this context, I developed this idea that it would be interesting to take a look at a period of German history that is, one has to say, very, very well researched, namely the 1520s or early 1530s in this context of German urban, imperial, territorial reformation and the responses by different groups, craftsmen or theologians and so on. And my idea was that this period that has been researched from so many angles could be in a way reconceptualized by placing the question of individual and collective decision-making in the center and asking if this quite conceptual or theoretical idea of decision-making, which is complicated in its own right, would be an interesting way to take a new look at this period and to link different themes like the media in the early Reformation or the dynamics in the cities or the specific theological developments, to link all these themes together and to show that this period is not one where there's a sudden change from clerical religious decision-making to individual decision-making. All of a sudden, every individual can and has to decide or choose his or her religion for him or herself, but that more interesting observation was that the established ways and procedures of making religious decisions collapse or are being heavily criticized, and there aren't yet any established new ones. So this is a period of uncertainty and experiment, I'd say. And this is what sparked my interest.
You talk about the concept of decision-making and the processes of decision-making. I find that quite interesting that you said you weren't really or only interested in the reasons for making a decision, but more in the discourses that surround the decision-making. And I just wanted to ask you how you go about that from the sources.
I think the complicated thing with decision making is that most of the theories in economics or in sociology are very much focused on the reasons or the motives and the outcomes of decision making, individual or collective decision making. And this is, of course, a methodical problem, because we can't look into the heads of the people, and we don't know what they think and why they decide or choose one thing and not the other. But the interesting thing is that in this period, there emerges a discussion about the possibilities, the limits, the ways of making individual decisions. And it's a very complex, sometimes ambivalent constellation of people are being pushed to choose a religious orientation. It is expected that everybody chooses, and at the same time, it's discouraged because it's not clear if it's not the urban or territorial authorities or the clerical authorities, the old ones or the new ones, or if it's maybe God that decides who is a real believer. So from a methodological point of view, I'd say for me as a historian, it is very interesting to observe this discussion about the problems of decision making and the way the people talk about it. So questions of semantics are quite interesting for me. And it's not a project on decision making in a sense of rational choice theory. So people are trying to maximize the outcome or whatever. This is an approach of which I'm quite critical, I'd say.
You're focusing on this period of the early Reformation, on a period when decision making is something that is very acute in a way. So people have to take a stand and have to decide which religious trend to follow. But what happens if you leave the early Reformation period and go into a later period, let's say into the 18th century? Is religious decision making different in the 18th century? Does the Enlightenment have some kind of impact on how people think about religious decision making?
Yes, I'd say there are differences. And my topic is very close to the well-established research discourse on religious conversion in early modern Europe. And I'd say for the later 16th century up to the 18th century, this question of religious or confessional conversion is quite central. And that is because it's very clear what the options are. Because from the 1540s, 50s, 60s on, there are well-established churches with well-established theologies and organizations. And then this question of crossing the border of a religion, choosing the other side, changes. So the other change is that after this early Reformation period, the dominant trend in early modern Europe was to place religious decisions not on every individual, but on territorial princes and so on. And this changes again from the 17th century on. In the 18th century, I'd say there is a trend towards a renewed greater individualization of religious decision making, because the sanctions are not so threatening anymore in the Enlightenment period. And at the same time, the Enlightenment period opens new ways of thinking about religion. It's not so dangerous anymore to be quite openly skeptical about the established religions. So I'd say this question of decision making in general and religious decision making especially can be researched or can be discussed in very different early modern and also modern settings. But this early Reformation period is so interesting because it is a well established master narrative, for instance, in the sociology of religions, that from the moment on where this established medieval church collapses or splits, people have to decide and can't decide. So this is a gain of personal freedom. I'd say for the 1520s, this is in a way true, but in a way it's much more complicated.
In your project, in a way, do you differentiate between different kind of categories of people who take decisions? Does it make a difference if a prince has to choose his religion, his faith, or is it the same with a commoner? The discourse is obviously different, but from your perspective as a historian, do you see a difference in who is involved in the decision-making, who is advising people, who is giving counsel?
I would say for the princes in the imperial diet, this question of decision-making is, of religious decision-making is on the one hand, for some of them, a highly personal question of individual piety. And on the other hand, it's from the outset, it's a political question because it has to do with a question of the positioning of the prince and his territory towards the empire and towards the emperor. And this is a situation of, I wouldn't say crisis of the empire, but a very, very complicated situation of external threat by the Ottoman Empire and an emperor who is most of the 1520s not present in the empire. So it's a political question. For other groups, maybe I could pick the humanists, which is a very interesting group in this context, because Luther and also Zwingli are, on the outset of the Reformation, are very much seen as part of this humanist camp that had in the 1510s already begun to very openly and publicly began opposing the established church institutions and universities and so on. And the humanists are then very surprised that this is not just a church reform program, but something that could lead and leads to a split within the church. So there are a lot of humanists who are very public figures. And so pressure is very, very high, much higher than for the normal commoner. And at the same time, the humanists are people who sometimes try to say, in the end, the unity of the church is much more important than the truth of the faith. So the humanist camp splits in a way in the 1520s because there are some that become supporters of Luther and the Reformation and some who very, very reluctantly, like Erasmus of Rotterdam, who actually doesn't change his position to a Catholic position, but he is a good example for someone who has always had the same position, the unity of the church, a very simple and simplified belief, very practical belief. And this is something that in the beginning is seen as part of the Reformation movement. And from the 1520s on, or the middle of the 1520s on, it becomes clear that the world has changed. Erasmus hasn't changed. The world has changed around him. And he has to say, okay, I'm either this or this. And this either-or logic is something that interests me. And this is something that you can very clearly see with the humanists, that they don't want this kind of either-or logic. And third example might be the common people, because it's very interesting. It's well known that the very early Reformation sees groups like women or craftsmen as authors of theological texts that are being printed, but also as people who are very much engaged in all kinds of religious discussions or are addressed by pamphlets and so on. So they play really a large role. And it is clear that there are a lot of common people who also feel this pressure to take sides without really knowing what the sides are, because the theological programs are not yet so clear and there aren't really any churches, an evangelical church and a Catholic church. So they are pushed to take sides without really knowing what these sides are. And of course, there are a lot of people in the humanist camp, but also with the commoners who just don't want to. And some of them get away with not making a decision. And some of the more public figures, like the prince of the humanist, eventually have to decide. But it's very clear that decision-making is something, coming back to this idea of a gain of liberty or personal freedom, decision-making in this Reformation context is something that people don't want to do because it's dangerous, it has consequences. Decision-making always marks a clear cut between me and the other one. I have to say I'm on this side, here I stand, and there's no going back in a way.
Your topic is obviously a fascinating one, but it's also huge. I think you're going to write a book about it.
Mm-hmm.
But even in a book, you probably can't exhaust all the different aspects of the topic. So what would you want other historians who come after you do in their research? What should they pick up? Well,
my idea would be a book that can also be seen as a series of essays that try to sketch in a not too long way certain possibilities. So I'd like to, for instance, like to write a chapter about one humanist, Erasmus, or the Strasbourg theologian Wolfgang Capito, which seem to be very typical in a way, in their way of deciding, not deciding, thinking about decision making, being reluctant, and so on. And I think I won't exhaust. My aim is to sketch a panorama of different possibilities, different discourses, the connections between these different things, but not to exhaust the topic in a way that I'd say I treat every humanist and every city and so on. So it's very exemplary. Additionally, I'd say it would be very interesting to try to apply this idea of religious decision-making also to other reformations. For instance, I have thought about the Italian Reformation and, of course, the English Reformation, which have their own problems and their own people. And so you are right. The topic is huge, and this is maybe a problem because I'd like to write a short book.
And thinking about our own present and kind of matters of decision-making, are there any processes or semantics that you would say remain constant regardless of the context?
I don't know if they remain constant, but from the start on, I've thought about this topic from 2015, 2016 on, and then I've worked on other things. Now I'm coming back to that. And of course, I can't say that this is a book about Donald Trump, but or the IFD or whatever. But my feeling is, and the growing feeling is, that we live in a time that is very much characterized by a pressure, also made bigger by the media, by the way we use media. We live in a time that's very much characterized by a pressure to take sides on whatever topic, gender, and a growing logic of, again, either or. We could discuss about the question of transgender. We could talk about the question of Israel and Palestine and so on and so forth. And it's something many people I know also observe, that it's becoming increasingly hard to state differentiated positions and to say on the one hand, the other hand, and or I don't know, or I don't want to take sides. So my feeling is, but I don't know if that's correct, but my feeling is that we live in a time where this all these ideas of taking sides, deciding between allegedly clear-cut options without knowing the consequences. This is for me, a really an everyday experience. So my feeling is also that this book is, in a way, although it's should be a very scholarly Reformation research book, in a way it's much more political than the things I've done before.
Thank you. That's really fascinating. And I hope that our listeners will enjoy listening to your lecture as much as we did. And we thank you so much for this great interview. and hope to see you soon.
Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.